Okay, so before we get into our text, if you haven't already, you can turn to Mark chapter 7. We'll be looking at verses 31 through 37. But just want to do a real quick overview, just a real quick review. When we started in Mark chapter 7, remember in the first 23 verses, we had talked about the confrontation that the Pharisees had with Jesus, more so with his disciples, because his disciples didn't wash their hands before they ate. And of course, we know it's more than just beyond, it goes beyond just cleaning their hands. They were talking about ceremonial washing. They really wanted to catch Jesus and his disciples at doing something wrong so they could point their fingers at him and discredit him. And so Jesus, instead, he focuses on their self-righteous legalism and really points to the fact that what they are teaching and what they hold to ignores the heart. The heart is that factory of evil. Out of the heart comes all these evil things. And so your legalistic religion is just ignoring the heart. That is the issue. And so as I mentioned last time in our study of the Syrophoenician woman, this confrontation with the Pharisees really serves as a huge contrast into what Jesus is doing now. Jesus, in verses 24 through 30, Jesus had left the Jewish area. He had left the area of Gennesaret. He left the Sea of Galilee, and he went over up into Tyre and Sidon, that area. That's Gentile country. That's unclean territory. And we had talked about this is a contrast between this confrontation that he just had with the self-righteous Pharisees and their legalism, and the purpose of why Christ came. And why Christ came is to bring salvation to the entire world. Now, why he decided to come to up into Tyre and Sidon out of Jewish territory and into Gentile territory, we kind of talked about there might have been more than one reason. We had said that he may have been leaving to get away from the opposition of the Pharisees and the scribes. We also talked about he was getting away from that superficial faith that many had as they were following him. They wanted things from him. They wanted miracles from him, but not necessarily that they wanted him. That could be. We also talked about that later on in Mark, he wants some time alone with his disciples so that he can teach them privately. He wants to train them up, get them ready for when he does die and when he is raised from the dead. They will have a mission to do. So he's trying to get them ready for that. Could be a combination of all of those things. Oh, and the other thing that I didn't mention was Herod. Herod was very suspicious of Jesus and who he was. He thought that he was John the Baptist brought back from the dead, so he's very suspicious of Jesus. So it could have been he was trying to get away from Herod as well. So certainly all of those could be in view as we looked at Mark 7, 24 through 30. And as they went up into Tyre, Jesus wanted some private time. And what happened? What cut their private time short?
The
Syrophoenician woman.
Yeah.
And we had talked about her. She didn't fit the profile of someone deserving salvation, did she? At least in the eyes of the scribes and Pharisees. They would certainly say that this woman was not deserving of salvation. She was a woman. She was a Gentile. She was a Roman Canaanite. She would be the exact opposite of the profile that the Pharisees had in their own minds. She was very much unclean. But she had a great need. And not only did she know about Jesus, but she knew exactly who he was. She agreed with his mission. She understood his mission. She agreed with him on the parable of the children and the dogs. She did not disagree with him at all. She agreed with him, and she had this expectation that the mercies that were going to be bestowed on the Jews would overflow and spill over to the Gentiles, to the dogs, to her. She had that expectation. And so this woman serves as a prelude of what is to come, that salvation goes to the Jews first and then to the Gentiles. And so does this passage before us today, in a matter of speaking. So if someone could read Mark chapter 7, verses 31 through 37, then we'll go through it verse by verse.
And he departed again from the coast of Tyre and Sidon, and came unto the Sea of Galilee, through the midst of the coasts of Decapolis. And they brought unto him one that was deaf and stammering in his speech, and prayed him to put his hand upon him. Then he took him aside from the multitude, and put his fingers in his ears, and did spit and touched his tongue, and looked up to heaven, he sighed, and said unto him, Ephphatha, that is, be opened. And straightway his ears were opened, and the string of his tongue was loosed, and he spoke plain. And he commanded them that they should tell no man. But how much soever he forbade them, the more a great deal he published it, and were beyond measure astonished, saying, He hath done all things well. He maketh both the deaf to hear and the dumb to speak.
Thank you, Don. So let's look at this verse by verse. First one, verse 31. It says, again, this is the NES. Again, he went out from the region of Tyre and came through Sidon to the Sea of Galilee within the region of Decapolis. So I've kind of drawn a map. This is not to scale, but we had talked about he went to Tyre. He's in this region. And the text says he went through Sidon, and where is he going?
Decapolis.
To the Decapolis. Does that make sense?
No.
It kind of does. I mean, there's a mountain range right here. Why wouldn't Jesus go, you know, right here? If he's planning to go to the Decapolis, why can't he just go right here? Well, we don't know for certain, although I have drawn this little dotted line here is Galilee. This is the area that he is supposedly trying to avoid for now. He's trying to stay in Gentile country. Now, there is a huge mountain range right here. And so to try to avoid Galilee and try to cross through here would be difficult. There is some thought that up here in this mountain range, there is a path into this valley right here. And he would have cut down through here to go to the Decapolis. But we don't know exactly what he was doing there. This would have been about a 120 to 150 mile journey for him. So it's kind of a horseshoe shape. He started at Gennesaret, went up here, came around, and came down to the Decapolis on that side of the Sea of Galilee. Decapolis, you notice anything with that word? Deca meaning
ten.
And polis is city. So Decapolis is an area of Gentile country made up of 10 cities. That's all that means. So again, we're not told why he went north into Sidon in order to go south, southeast to Decapolis. But that is the route that he traveled. And we don't know exactly how long Jesus was in Gentile territory, how long he spent this circuitous trip. But it would have to be at least longer than a day. And it probably had to have been shorter than a year, because this is his last year of ministry. So, don't know. Maybe a few weeks, maybe a few months. We're not for certain. The text gives us no other details other than that's where he went. Yeah. And as we talked about before, the scribes and Pharisees would not want to follow him, because that's unclean. That's unclean territory. So they would have had some amount of privacy. How much, we don't know. Because again, as we talked about, when people heard about Jesus, they came from the Decapolis. They came from Tyre and Sidon, and they searched for him in this area. So We don't know. There's not enough detail there to tell us anything. Anything that we try to say, it would be conjecture. Now, Matthew does add a little bit of additional detail for us as far as what's going on in Decapolis. We don't know anything that happened from Sidon down to the Decapolis, but Matthew does add some detail for us as to what happens at the Decapolis. So turn to Matthew chapter 15, and let's look at verses 29 and 30. Somebody has that, please read it for us.
And Jesus went on from there and walked beside the Sea of Galilee. And he went up on the mountain and sat down there. And great crowds came to him, bringing with them the lame, the blind, the crippled, the mute, and many others. And they put him at his feet, and he healed them. Okay. So that the crowd wondered.
Okay, so missing from at least the immediate context of Mark is that large crowds have gathered to Jesus where he has stationed himself on a mountain. We're not sure what mountain it's referring to, but this area just to the east of the Sea of Galilee does have some mountains. And I did this yesterday and it was kind of fun. If you ever use Google Maps and you take the little guy and you plop him in the map, that's what I did. And it's just kind of interesting to see. They're not going to be Rocky Mountains by any means. But to us, they would be mountains. And you could easily go on top of them. So it's quite possible. Some of those mountain ranges there, that's where Jesus went and sat. And he would have been able to oversee the Sea of Galilee. It's just kind of neat. So if you ever get a chance to do that, it's kind of neat thing to think about as you're thinking through where Jesus might have gone. So what meets him at this mountain?
A crowd.
Large crowds. And how large are these crowds? Well, if you continue on in the context of Matthew, this includes the feeding of the 4,000 in this time frame. So, in fact, Jesus says, just later on there in Matthew, he says the crowd has been following him for 3 days. And because of this, they're running out of food. And Mark says, in Mark chapter 8, verse 1, it says, in those days, in his description of the feeding of the 4,000, in those days, referring to his time right now in the Decapolis. So, just like the feeding of the 5,000, where its size is estimated to roughly about five times that of what is listed, we get 25,000 there. Here we have an estimated size of a crowd of 20,000. So this is the size of the crowd. They met him there in the Decapolis on top of a mountain. And what are they doing?
He's healing them.
They're bringing people.
Yeah, they're bringing all their sick, the ones that have various infirmities, the lame, the crippled. While you're in Matthew, turn over to Matthew chapter 18. I just kind of want to give you a little bit of frame of reference on what Scripture means by lame and crippled. So Matthew 18, verse 8, it says, if your hand or your foot causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it from you. It is better for you to enter life crippled or lame than to have two hands or two feet and be cast into the eternal fire. So when we are talking about the lame and the crippled, these could quite possibly be people who don't have hands, don't have feet. They may be missing digits, toes, fingers. That's what lame and crippled means. May have had deformed body parts, missing body parts. And so they're bringing him the lame, the crippled. They're also bringing him the blind, the mute, and others that have all sorts of different maladies. And of course, Jesus is healing them. And just think about that. Those that had difficulty walking can now walk perfectly. Those that could not grip things, they can now do that with no difficulty. Those that were missing what we ought normally to have as part of our created bodies, those that can't see, those can't talk and communicate, and many other maladies, Jesus is giving them hands, he's giving them feet, he's giving them fingers, toes, he's giving them ears to hear, eyes to see. He's linking all of those things to their brain so that they can make them work. He's forming all the bones, all the muscles. It's amazing, staggering to think about that. That's the miracles that Jesus is doing. So, back to Mark. Let's go back to Mark chapter 7, verse 32. Now we know the context of this huge crowd that is gathering. So verse 32, they brought to him one who was deaf and spoke with difficulty, and they implored him to lay his hand on him. So amongst all the healing that is going on, Mark records for us this particular encounter with this man. And none of the other gospel accounts have this. And I'll touch on this more later when we get down to verse 35. Because Mark, his recording this encounter has more significance than what you might see at first when you just read through this passage at face value. So we'll dig into that a little bit more. So Mark is providing yet another healing in Gentile country in this gospel account of Mark. Remember that his audience is Romans. It's Gentiles. And so this is more information for them that they would be highly encouraged to see and to read. So they, says they brought to him. Well, who are the they? Who could that be? Don't know. Could be the crowds. Could just be a bunch of people that see this man. They know him. They bring him to Jesus. Could be friends. Could be family. We don't know. What we do know is the text says that they implored Jesus, or they begged him to lay his hands on him. So that's indicative that they had a really great care and concern for this man. They would have known him to some extent, and they clearly wanted Jesus to heal him. And they asked Jesus to do for this man what this man could not verbally ask for, right? He wanted to be healed, and this man can't say that. He can't communicate that, at least by mouth. So how is the man described that is brought to Jesus?
Deaf and impediment in speech.
Deaf and impediment in speech, or he spoke with difficulty, or could hardly talk in other translations. What does your translation say, Don?
Stammered,
okay. So we can understand and think we can put ourselves in the place of this man that if you cannot hear, what does that do to your speech? Makes it very difficult. We can't hear the sound that our mouths are making, and we can't hear the sound that others are making toward us. And so with him being deaf, not able to hear, he can't communicate with his mouth. That's the kind of impediment that he has. So it's near impossible for a deaf person to really communicate with their mouths. And so their primary forms of communication would be through what they can see and also possibly what they can feel or touch. So I want you to keep that in mind. That's important to keep in mind as we look at what Jesus does with this man. And we also need to think about what life for this man would look like. It would have been extremely difficult for him to live. If this man were an Israelite, he would be considered an outcast. Remember, anyone that has any kind of malady, they would be considered cursed by God. So if he was an Israelite, he would be considered cursed. And actually, they would consider such a man insane because they have no idea what he is trying to say. They don't understand him, so they just kind of cast him aside, say he's insane, and move on with their lives. And there is a certain stigma, of course, associated with that, and so we can only assume that this is present in other cultures as well, particularly in Gentile country. We don't know that for sure, but certainly life for this man would have been very, very difficult. So looking at verse 33 and 34, we're going to see what Jesus does with him. It says, Jesus took him aside from the crowd by himself and put his fingers into his ears. And after spitting, he touched his tongue with the saliva. And looking up to heaven with a deep sigh, he said to him, Ephphatha, that is, be opened. Now, what we see here first, we see Jesus taking this man aside from the crowd. What significance would that be for this man? If you put yourself in this man's shoes, what significance would that be to him?
Acceptance.
Acceptance?
Teacher's not afraid to be with him.
Yeah. This is a very compassionate and kind thing that Jesus is doing. This man is considered an outcast. He is pushed aside. And here, out of this crowd of 20,000, Jesus stops what he's doing. He takes this man aside privately in order to deal with him. This is the kind of kindness and compassion that Jesus has. He wanted to deal with him personally. And if Jesus wanted to deal with this man personally, we need to understand what Jesus is doing from the man's perspective, right? This is tailored specifically for him. What Jesus is going to do is specifically for him. So remember, he cannot hear. And he cannot communicate verbally, but he can see and he can feel. So Jesus provides for this man some signs that he can see and also feel to help him really exercise faith in his own way of communication. So putting yourself in the place of the man, what might Jesus putting his fingers in your ears mean? Yeah. Why do we normally put our fingers in our ears?
To block sound.
To block sound. Exactly. You might do that at different events, just really loud, so you plug your ears. And so Jesus is doing that. He's saying, I understand you have a problem with your ears. That is communicating to this man that you have a stoppage. There's something wrong with your ears. Okay?
I wonder, does this guy have any concept, really? How did he understand what was going on? And stuff? I don't know. The people brought him instead, but did he really understand what was going on?
I don't know. There's no indication of that.
Picture of salvation, I guess.
Yeah. There's really no indication to say that this man knows what's going on, except for this personal encounter with Jesus. He doesn't. There's no communication with this man to say, "Whoa, hey, what are you doing?" He's letting it happen.
Well, I mean, he's not blind. He could have seen lame people getting up and walking and said, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Maybe this guy can help me too.
Yep.
We just don't have any concept of what goes on in a person's mind like that. How do they learn that kind of thing?
Yeah. And, yeah, this is him, from what I can tell, this is his way of exercising faith. We don't see exactly what is going on, but he trusts that Jesus is able to do what he's about to do. So, again, putting yourself in the place of the man, what do you think Jesus spitting and taking that saliva and placing it on your tongue, what might that signify?
Well, again, that he understands
can't talk.
There's a problem.
Yeah, that's it. He's just showing him, I understand, not only do you have a problem with your ear, you also have a problem with your tongue, with your speech. That's all that he's saying. He's communicating to the man exactly what he knows is the problem. Now, as for the saliva, that's not really readily apparent. Why Jesus had to spit? Did Jesus have to spit in order to heal this man?
No.
So there has to be something else here. He could have simply spoke and this man was healed. So in the use of this spittle, Jesus is using it as a means of communicating or demonstrating something. That has to be it, because he didn't need to spit. So, and as I studied this, there are some commentators that kind of swing this way too far to a more, they see this as more of a sacramental thing. His spit is, has some kind of sacramental value to it. I just don't see that at all. But in both Jewish and Gentile cultures, spit was seen as a healing agent. And so it is possible that with the culture's high view of spit, Jesus was communicating to the man of his intentions of healing him. That is what I could gather in my studying of why the spit. It doesn't make sense that there's something magical or spiritual about the spit. It's some kind of communication, some kind of demonstration to this man.
Well, in different cultures, Christians go in and they do things, use things out of the culture to communicate the scriptures. So,
yeah. And that's where I arrived, was it doesn't make sense that there's something special about this spit that instead Jesus is communicating to him.
So
now,
would the Jews have even thought that that was okay? Or would they, I mean, I know they're not, I'm like, we're talking Gentiles, but would that, they were okay with spit, it wasn't unclean?
Well, any bodily fluids would be considered unclean, but it's interesting in at least, and I didn't dive too far into this, but one commentator suggested that that was a Jewish thing as well, that they used spit as sort of a salve for cuts and things. So, you know, that could have been a healing agent that they would have to then go, once you've used it, then you got to go cleanse yourself. So... So yeah, it's used in both Jewish and Gentile cultures, even though in Jewish culture, bodily fluids are unclean. Now it's interesting, now that Loretta's brought that up, just to think about the contrast of Jesus dealing with this man and how the Pharisees might have dealt with this man. How might the Pharisees deal with him?
They ban him.
We don't want anything to do with him.
They definitely wouldn't have touched him.
Exactly. They wouldn't have touched his ears. They wouldn't have done... Yeah, they wouldn't have touched him. That would have made them unclean. And they're certainly not going to be messing with his bodily fluids. This would have been a very unclean experience for them. So what Jesus is doing with this man is very kind, very compassionate. Now, what might the significance of Jesus looking up to heaven be? Yeah, and we've seen this before in the feeding of the 5,000. Jesus looks up to heaven, doesn't he, before he prays. It's kind of a show of dependence upon his Father for what is about to happen. So this is an action of prayer, a sign of dependence on the Father, on what is about to transpire. Now, as for the deep sigh, we're not really told anything about the significance behind that. Some commentators suggest that it is a sign of Jesus' compassion upon this man. Could very well be. Others suggest that it's just a sigh of sympathy and just pain, a lot of emotions wrapped up in that. Because what is the reason for this man's condition?
Sin.
So it's just a sigh of pain, compassion for people that are wrapped up in the different maladies that we have are a result of sin, and this man is no different. And Jesus' prayer consists of one word. This is probably an Aramaic word. It's ephatha, and Mark provides us a definition for that. It's just be opened. And what happened? Verse 35.
His ears were opened and his tongue was released.
Yeah.
And he spoke plainly.
Yeah, the healing is immediate. It says, and his ears were open, the impediment of his tongue was removed, and he began speaking plainly. So the healing's immediate, his ears are opened, he can hear clearly, perfectly now. The impediment, that word there is kind of interesting, that the word used there is also used for bonds or chains. So this bond and chain of his tongue, it was removed. His tongue is set free. Now, could this man, at this point, having his ears opened and his mouth loosened, could he have been healed?
Sure. What? Could he be?
Yeah. It goes on to say, and he began speaking plainly. But just with the ears opened and the mouth fixed, would you consider the man healed?
Physically.
Yeah. What would he have to do, though? Yeah, he would have to learn how to talk, which would take a long time to do.
Maybe not. Where you're going. God created the universe.
And that's my point. That's my point, is Jesus could have just healed his ears and healed his mouth, and this man would have had to go on and learn how to speak. He can now hear, he can now speak, he can learn that, but the text says, and he began speaking plainly. The text says that word for plainly is orthos. It's rightly, correctly, or in a straight manner. That orthos is where we get orthopedics. Orthopedics, it deals with the correcting of muscle and bone. So this man is able to speak correctly and plainly immediately. There's no need for speech therapy. There's none of that needed. So somehow, when Jesus healed his ears and healed his mouth, he also healed his brain so that his mouth could make those vocal sounds needed to communicate. He could understand the vocal sounds that people were making. He was able to communicate immediately.
Jesus also does that when he heals the lame. You know, he says, get up and walk. He didn't have to learn to walk.
Yeah.
They walk.
Exactly.
They have full facility.
Exactly. And why not? This is the same God who confused languages at Babel, right? He could fix languages just like that. And that's exactly what happened.
You mean he didn't infuse the ability into him? He imputed it.
Mm-hmm. Now, real briefly, I want to go back to verse 32, because this is the part that hopefully I can draw out and help you see a little bit better. I want to look at verse 32. There's a particular word that Mark uses here is translated, at least in the NAS, as spoke with difficulty. So this man spoke with difficulty. That word is magilalas. And it'd just be very easy to read through verse 32 and not see what Mark is doing. But with one word, he is making a very significant statement. It is used only one other time in the entire Bible and is found in the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, and it is doubtless that Mark is using this here as a coincidence. He is making a huge statement here. And where it is used is in Isaiah chapter 35. Turn there, please. Now, as you're turning there, Mark doesn't typically link what he's trying to say to the Old Testament. He doesn't usually do that because you have to consider his audience. They are Roman Gentiles. They would not be familiar with the Old Testament. But when he does, it is very significant and profound. And one commentator says he likens it to a load-bearing beam when Mark does this. Now, if you were to look at Isaiah, there are essentially two parts. There's the part of judgment, judgment particularly on Edom, Egypt, Tyre, and Jerusalem and Israel. And then the second part is about salvation for Israel and also to the entire world through the Messiah. And chapter 35 is the beginning of that transition from judgment to salvation. And the way that Mark uses this word magilalas is found in verses 5 and 6 of Isaiah chapter 35. Somebody could read that for me.
Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then shall the lame man leap like a deer, and the tongue of the mute sing for joy, For waters break forth in the wilderness and streams in the desert.
Okay, so that tongue of the mute, that is the mute is magilalas. That's the word. And it's just interesting to think about that. So when you get to chapter 35, the shift goes from judgment to looking ahead to the future. This is looking at eschatology, the end, when the day of the Lord comes. This is talking about his millennial reign. That's that shift starting in chapter 35. And if you look just very briefly at Isaiah chapter 35, it talks about Israel, talks about Carmel and Sharon, and it says that they will be renewed, they will flourish, but it will extend beyond Israel to the desert and the wastelands of Lebanon, where they too will receive the joy of God. And we didn't talk about this last week, but the regions of Tyre and Sidon are the Lebanon of Isaiah chapter 35. This Gentile territory that he is talking about right there in Isaiah 35 when he speaks of Lebanon. Isaiah 35:8 speaks of a highway of holiness leading to Zion. And verse 9 tells us that the redeemed, the ransomed ones, will be the ones traveling it. And those redeemed and ransomed ones will not only be made up of Jews, but also of Gentiles. And so this healing of this particular Gentile deaf and you could say mute man is a preview of what is to come. That people from every tribe, tongue, and nation will gather into his kingdom and be healed and be saved. So, why does Mark do this? Why does Mark link this to Isaiah 35? What is he trying to say?
That the man was saved.
Could be. Yeah. This is this man Jesus, this man that just did this for this other man, he is the Messiah. There's no mistake there. He is clearly linking Isaiah chapter 35, which speaks of the coming, and the rest of Isaiah speaks of the coming of the Messiah. So Mark is making that statement. He's showing that Jesus is the Savior of the world.
He's linking it to the Abrahamic covenant, which says the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so this would include his Roman Gentile readers. So it's important to see that. Now, getting into verse 36 of Mark chapter 7. This is a hard verse. It says, and he gave them, who's the he? Jesus. He gave them orders not to tell anyone. But the more he ordered them, the more widely they continued to proclaim it. So this is a kind of a hard passage to really take in and understand. And those that witness this miracle are commanded by Jesus not to tell anyone about it. Don't tell anybody what you saw. But perhaps hardest of all is that this command is also to this man, right? This man that just had his ears open and his tongue loosened and is now able to communicate is now told he cannot talk about this. That's got to be hard for him. And perhaps even more puzzling is, if you remember back in Mark chapter 5, Jesus told the Gerasene demoniac to tell everyone what happened. And so in verse 20 of Mark 5, we see that he went and proclaimed in the Decapolis, where they are at, everyone, he told everyone what Jesus did for him. So, that begs the question, between this demoniac and now, why might Jesus command people to be silent about what they saw? What has changed?
Is he playing, you're using reverse psychology? Because the more you say, don't tell anybody, the more we're going to, you know, people's nature is to say,
I see what you're saying, but that would mean that Jesus was trying to manipulate people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we know that's not Jesus' character.
I think he was trying to be discreet in his travel.
Okay.
Trying to be alone.
Mm-hmm. Could be.
But
they still
didn't
are
want that recognition.
Looking, although he's a healer. He does miracles.
Yeah. That knowledge of Jesus, of being just a healer and a miracle worker, is inadequate. That is not a full picture of who Jesus is it? And so when you try to reconcile the fact that Jesus says to the Gerasene demoniac, it's okay if you go tell everyone, did anybody know about Jesus in the Decapolis yet?
No.
With the Gerasene demoniac? No. And we talked about that when we looked at Mark chapter 5, that he was this former demoniac who had the legion of demons inside him was the first missionary in the Decapolis. He went and told people about Jesus. Now that people know about Jesus, they're coming to him in huge crowds, but the problem is all they see are the healings and the miracles. They don't see the full picture of who Jesus is.
Because they sent him away. I mean, they wanted him to get out of there.
Yes, they were when he healed the Gerasene demoniac, they were afraid of his power. And so they wanted him to leave. And that's why he said, you stay, you tell them about who I am.
Well, the idea is, though, they're not going to understand that anyway until it's explained by the Holy Spirit.
Yeah.
That is true, too.
So they're Gentiles. They don't know anything about salvation.
Right.
Well, neither the Jews, yeah.
Now, I want you to turn to Luke chapter 9. I think this will help us understand what's going on here a little bit better. Luke chapter 9, verses 18 through 22. And it happened that while he was praying alone, the disciples were with him, and he questioned them, saying, who do the people say that I am? They answered and said, John the Baptist, and others say Elijah, but others that one of the prophets of old has risen again. And he said to them, but who do you say that I am? And Peter answered and said, the Christ of God. But he warned them and instructed them not to tell this to anyone. Why? The Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes, and be killed and be raised up on the third day. So the full picture is not there for the disciples. And he tells the disciples, don't tell everyone that I am the Christ of God. Yes, that is who I am. But this is not, the whole mission is not done yet. And so we can project that onto this situation as well. That he does not want them to tell everyone what they saw, because he still has the mission of the cross before him yet. That still has to happen. That's the entire gospel message. It's not just that Jesus is a healer and miracle worker. It's that he also brings salvation by the sacrifice of himself and his resurrection. It's not yet complete. But after the resurrection, what does he tell the disciples to do?
Go and tell.
Go and tell. After the whole message is done, go and tell everyone, go and make disciples of all nations, telling them who I am. But, much like the Jews who disobeyed this command of silence, so do the Gentiles. Why?
He knew that. He knew they were
going to
do that.
He did. He would know that. But why? Why can't they contain this? Well, I think it tells us in the next verse, verse 37, says they were utterly astonished, saying, he has done all things well. He makes even the deaf to hear and the mute to speak. So they couldn't contain it because they were so utterly astonished. And that word utterly astonished, it means beyond measure, in the extreme. They had their minds blown by what they saw, what they witnessed. They couldn't contain it. And Matthew basically says the same thing with some added detail in Matthew 15:31, it says, "So the crowd marveled as they saw the mute speaking, the crippled restored, and the lame walking, and the blind seeing, and they glorified the God of Israel." Now, more than one commentator, as I was studying this, they focus on this phrase, "He has done all things well," in Mark. Certainly, the people saw that every time he healed, it was perfect. It was complete. It wasn't a partial healing. It was a perfect healing. The mute now spoke. The crippled and the lame now walk. The blind now see. The deaf now hear. They were healed completely. There was nothing left to be desired, was there? Certainly not for this man. He could have just had his ears open and his mouth loosened, but what he needed beyond that was knowing how to speak, and this man certainly was not left that way. He was healed perfectly, completely. So he was, as I mentioned earlier, he was creating for them new ears, new arms, new feet, new eyes, new tongues, new digits, and so on by speaking it into existence. Does this remind you of anything? What's that?
New bodies.
Well, that is true.
Creation.
Reminds us of creation. When God created the world, each day he said it was good, and finally on the sixth day he said it was very good. He has done all things well. And then you go over and look at John 1:1-3. "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through him, and apart from him, nothing came into being that has come into being." The Word, of course, being Jesus Christ. All things came into being through him, and all things made were good and very good. He has done all things well. Any other thoughts on this passage? Yes, Jason.
I kind of feel like, and this is not probably the best illustration, but it's what it reminds me of the most, is when you're planning to do something like a surprise for your kids, and it's a fairly big surprise, and it's required some coordination, and one of them either had a bad day, or just, you know, you're having compassion on them, so you're like, "Hey, we're gonna do this thing. Don't tell any of your brothers or sisters." And then all of a sudden, one of the younger ones starts asking about, like, "Hey, I heard we were doing it." It's that kind of thing. It's not the same as gossip, but like when you know something's cool about to happen, you're excited and you want to tell people, mm-hmm. even though you're like, "I'm not supposed to tell anybody."
Mm-hmm.
So like you'd be like, you know, you can even in your heart be like, "I'm not gonna tell anyone," and you're like, "Oh, but I want to tell somebody." So
I'm sure all of us have done it sometime in our life.
This is perfectly consistent with the Jewish, because they're expecting a physical Messiah.
Yeah.
So they see all these physical things, and that, hey.
Yeah. It's no wonder that they're excited. This is amazing work that Jesus is doing. It's complete. It's perfect. He's done all things well. It would be very difficult to contain it.
Yeah, they are worshiping the God of the Jews. Unfortunately, it's not the God of Christ.
But one thing in Matthew that I didn't bring it out, but it says that they worship the God of Israel. That's important to know that they are the ones saying that, because there are some people that doubt where they're at right now. They think, there are some commentators out there that think that when he's speaking to the crowds in the Decapolis, that crowd is made up of Jews only. But that statement, "they worship the God of Israel," is clear that it is Gentiles he is talking to.
And which Israel are we talking about? Physical Israel, spiritual?
Well, the same God that the Jews worship, yes. Any other thoughts on this passage?
Well, my first thing when I read that was not so much what everybody else, you know, that they're saying, you know, this is what he did. But how would the man himself explain that without telling that when he's, how would he answer a question of what happened to you without, I mean, otherwise he would have to say, "I can't tell you."
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's just like.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a seemingly impossible command. Yeah. Now, as we look at application, just trying to see, okay, how does this apply to us? And I think Barb hit it on the head earlier. We see a preview of what is yet to come, right? We do, certainly, especially when you look back at Isaiah 35 and see what is to come. We're reminded about creation, certainly, and that Jesus has that power over creation, that prior to sin, everything was made very good. It was made perfectly. And then once sin entered in, the world has been tainted, it's been cursed. We see the results of sin all around us. And so did Jesus. He saw in that crowd of 20,000 all sorts of people that were affected by sin. And we see it today. We see cancer. We see things that modern medicine just cannot answer. And for some of those things, all modern medicine can do is try to manage that sickness. That's all it can do. And because of sin, death entered into the world. And every person has sin and death now in common. That is the results. But as Barb mentioned, we long for when Christ returns. When he returns, he sets everything right. We are given glorified bodies. There's no more pain. There's no more sickness. There's no more death. There's no more sin. We will see him face to face as he is, and peace and righteousness will reign. That is what we look forward to. We'll no longer suffer, and we will instead live for him in eternity. And that is what we can be reminded of here. What happened with this man is amazing, but the most amazing thing is yet to come still. And we can look to that and look forward to it. Any other thoughts, questions? Okay. Well, let me pray, and then we'll be dismissed to continue your worship of our great God in the great room. Father, we thank you. We thank you for who you are and for what you've done and what you have done and also what you will do. And Father, we look forward to that. We long for that. We long for when Christ will come, where he will reign upon this earth and peace and righteousness and justice will be perfected. It will be on this earth. We look forward to that. We look forward also to when there is no more crying, there's no more pain, there's no more tears. You wipe them away for us. We look forward to when there's no more death, there is no more sin, that our constant wrestling with sin will be no more. It is unfathomable for us as we struggle with sin on a daily basis, and to just suddenly be free of that, we long for that, Lord. Father, thank you for this reminder of this man and the power that you have over creation. And we long again for Christ to return. It's in his name that we pray. Amen.